Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. If you would like to support what I do, grab a paid subscription on Substack and read past posts like today's book review. This week, book review, Agriculture of the Hidatsa Indians. This odd little ebook crossed my path, and it's available for free on Project Gutenberg. In it, the testimony of a Hidatsa elder, Maxie Dewiak, translated as Buffalo Bird Woman, was recorded by an anthropologist in the summer of 1912 with the translation assistance from her son Goodbird. She was born in 1839 and had carried on her people's traditional methods of cultivation despite being relocated to a reservation far from her original land. In their people's legends, they once cultivated ground beans and wild potatoes, later abandoned for use as wild forage when maize and other crops were introduced. When their tribe migrated upriver, the gardens were slowly cleared from the forest over many years until they were as large as they could manage. Maize was introduced to the Hidatsa from a neighbouring village, with roasted cobs attached to arrows fired from a distance to prevent conflict. Beans, squash, and sunflowers were later introduced. Firewood shortages induced the people to move to a new location after some time. Smallpox arrived shortly afterwards, killing more than half the population. The survivors moved to yet another location, where the narrator farmed until the arrival of white settlers. Clearing fields was a major task, and locations with rich black-bottom soil were selected. Prairie land was unsuitable for cultivation. Buffalo Bird Woman grew up using heavy iron hoes, but traditionally digging sticks and bone hoes had been used in the past. Shrubs were cut with axes. Stakes or stone piles marked the corner of claimed family fields to avoid disputes. Biomass was cut and piled for burning. Soil was mounded in rows and sowed with maize around 4 feet apart. A few years later, the family cleared a second field on the other side of the village, around 75 by 100 yards, approximately 1.5 acres. The largest field mentioned in the account was around 3.2 acres. Fields were often over a kilometre away from the village in order to use the best patches of soil. Sunflowers were sowed around the field edges, 9 paces apart, as soon as the ice melted in spring. I wonder if they were using the allelopathic effect of this crop to limit wild grass growing into the field. Sunflower heads were harvested in autumn, as they yellowed, to avoid birds eating them in the field, then ripened and dried back at camp. Learning this made me wonder if I could produce sunflower here if I timed the harvest more carefully to avoid bird pressure. The Hidatsa sunflower harvest was staggered as the heads were dried and threshed out. Smaller wild sunflowers were harvested directly in marginal places where they grew. 2 or 3 sacks of dried sunflower seeds supplied the family over the winter. Seed was parched in a clay pot on the coals, then pounded into a meal. Maize was sowed next, for a month or so, at the time when wild gooseberry leaves bushed out. The same mounds were reused every year, with the roots of the previous crop dug out and burned in spring during the sowing process. A shallow depression was scraped out of the hilltop, then an array of corn seeds planted to create a carefully spaced clump of plants. Later, as the corn grew, the surrounding space was hoed to supply soil to the mounds. Maize grown with mounds too close together produced small, underdeveloped crops. A morning's work would involve planting over 200 such mounds. Late-season maize was sowed in water before sowing. Beans were then sowed in smaller mounds in rows which alternated between the maize rows. Larger rows of squash were sowed between blocks of maize and beans. As the corn grew, daily hoeing kept the weeds in check and built up the mounds, with hand weeding on the mounds themselves. Weeds were left on the ground to die. Weed pressure got worse when introduced European species arrived, and horse manure was tried and abandoned since it introduced even more weeds. When the corn was 8 inches high, weeding usually stopped. Hilling recommenced when the maize flowered. Seed-producing weeds were carried off the field at this stage. Crows and magpies pulled up maize seedlings, which needed re-sowing, so they built scarecrows. A raised platform was built to watch the crop from while the cobs were maturing. Booths were built for cooking green corn, shelters built from bent willow branches. Green corn was picked based on the external characteristics, which the younger farmers forgot how to apply, so they opened cobs that were immature and wasted them. Note that I am going through a similar process, learning to pick fully mature cobs as soon as possible to minimize losses to birds and vermin. Ripe corn was harvested, leaving the stalks in place. Husking feasts relied on seasonal hunted meat to gift the workers. A family often took 3 days to husk all their corn. Youngsters used this season to spend their time with their sweethearts. The best cobs were braided to save for sowing seed, with rounded seed from the middle of the cob sowed next spring. Saved seed would germinate well for 2 years, but be dead by the fourth year. The Hidatsa always saved enough seed for 2 years' worth of sowing in case of crop failure. Surplus seed could be sold to less organized families. Any immature cobs were eaten immediately. Smaller ears were carried home in baskets to be dried and threshed. Wooden flails were used to thresh the maize seed inside a small booth lined with buffalo skin to catch the flying seed. A pile of cobs about 5 feet high was processed each day for many days. Thresh cobs were burnt to produce a prized ash used for seasoning food. Thresh grain was dried a little more than winnowed before storage. The grain was stored in bull boats, a leather-lined basket around the size of a bathtub, with 3 to 5 of these stored for a family of 10. Only rarely stored corn ran out in the spring, but the tribe shifted to hunting to cover the gap. Excess maize was traded with neighboring tribes for skins and dried meat. The Hidatsa grew 9 distinct varieties of maize, each for a different type of dish, grown in separate scattered plots to maintain purity. Squash seed was sowed next at the start of summer. Seed were moistened and pre-germinated in hide bags, mixed with damp grass and sage leaves. Seed were sowed in rows between maize and bean plots, on the sides of mounds built for squash in previous years, 4 seed in each mound. The fruit were harvested immature to begin, cooked with green corn. More mature fruit were sliced and dried on willow rods, once the rate of production was more than could be eaten. Once dry, they were threaded onto grass strings for storage. Harvesting and drying squash took the women a month most years. Squash blossoms were also dried. The best-looking squash fruit were left mature, then harvested for seed saving. Dried corn cobs were used to absorb the moisture from mature squash seed pulp, then the seeds were spread to dry for storage. Beans were sown immediately after squash in early summer, on the sides of small hills in rows between the maize. The crops were harvested in fall when the pods were mostly dried, with the vines pulled and dried for a few more days in the field if the weather was damp. Beans were threshed on the edge of field by trampling on a hide. The threshed vines got a final beating with sticks to break lingering pods. Beans were then winnowed, carried home, and dried before storage. Bean harvests varied a lot year to year, from half a sack to 3 barrels full. During winter, many crops were stored in an underground cache pit to protect them from frost. The mouth was up to 2 feet wide, and the chamber grew wider with depth, up to a few meters deep in large ones, necessitating the use of a ladder. The walls were lined with dried grass pinned with willow sticks, then dried corn cobs were stacked against the walls. The floor was dry willow sticks covered with a hide, and the lid covered carefully with earth to hide the cache from opportunists who might enter the summer village when the tribe was living away in their winter village. The rest of the account features detailed instructions for the construction of drying structures, fences, hand tools, the layout of the village between families, the cycles of fallowing land, managing frost, and how their culture adapted to the arrival of crops and technology from Europeans. There is only a little I want to say to round out the summary of the points I found most interesting as an aspiring post-industrial farmer. The first is that the approximate land area and volumes of staple crops being produced accords with my estimates from other sources. Namely, this is much more than most suburbanites appreciate, such that suburban gardening is unlikely to ever produce more than vegetables to add to a staple crop diet sourced from industrial production. This book suggests that about 1 Indian acre per person of fields was necessary, though much of their meat came from hunting. I can't find a detailed conversion for this unit of area, but I suspect it is slightly smaller than a modern standard acre, but this still accords with the roughly half to 2 acres of staple crops needed on decent land per person that I've estimated from other sources. The specific techniques required to produce a minimal diversity of staple crops and the amount of time, skill, and coordination is impressive, but is obviously doable given the last few millennia of history. It is encouraging to see how much this community achieved with 4 crop species represented as a diverse patchwork of complementary strains, though they relied heavily on wild resources and trading with nomadic neighbours to round out their diet. Based on the amount of time the women spent farming, I estimate a time-weighted energy return on energy invested of around 5, with women spending about 4 months a year dedicated to farming, leaving the men free to hunt full-time and enough spare resources to support small children and the elderly. The observation that these tribes only cultivated the very best locations in their landscape, often walking long distances to establish new fields, highlights the need for a whole landscape to support a pre-industrial society. Just picking a few random acres and imposing your expectations about how much food it should produce is a recipe for disappointment. The Hidatsa mention white people ploughing up the prairie to plant maize and how substandard the resulting grain was to their tastes. These tastes and instincts prevented creeping malnutrition and the unreliable year-to-year production that any society risks producing food from marginal locations. Our modern industrial agriculture represents this dynamic on steroids. One final thought worth sharing. This woman was born nearly 200 years ago and represented one of the last pre-industrial agriculturalist generations on the planet. Even they only got maize and other imported crops a few centuries before that. This account is a very rare example of hearing the words directly from such people. Even then, her generation was already losing the ability to work with pre-industrial tools such as digging sticks, bone hoes, and stone axes. A lot of people view anything from before World War I as traditional, but the roots of industrialization and the corresponding loss of skills and resources goes back several centuries, even in the West. Many of the fine details are now lost, and Western farming has been dependent on imported salt and iron tools and the elites that produce them for many centuries. I doubt that even this account would contain enough information to recreate a comparable village in the same location, even assuming that suitable crop genetics could be located to build upon. The unavoidable truth is that post-industrial skills and crops will need to be reinvented on the basis of experimentation at least as much as they will be recreated by studying history.